Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's May 1st, 2014 7th Annual Conference, Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin chaired this 12-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 2, Regulatory and Inspection Priorities for Private Fund Advisors. Timothy Levin and Jennifer Klass will discuss recent trends in the SEC examination process, as well as current and important regulatory and inspection priorities for private fund advisors in the hedge fund industry. Now, on to the podcast.
Today, we are going to bring you up to date on some recent developments in the SEC's examination program, and then focus on some specific SEC examination priorities for 2014, which we're going to divide into things that touch upon market-wide initiatives, issues that the staff has identified as core risks, talk about some new and emerging issues, and then talk about policy topics. And of course, we also welcome you to participate during our presentation. If you have any questions, please don't hesitate to put your hand up, and we're happy to speak to your particular issues. And so with that, Jen, maybe you want to kick us off with some of the recent developments.
Sure. Thanks, Tim. I think it's worth starting our discussion today by noting that in congressional testimony in April, Chair White has really been very focused on what she calls the immediate and pressing need for significant additional resources relating to investment advisor examinations. This is congressional testimony relating to the proposed fiscal year 2015 budget at the SEC. And it's interesting when you read her comments that a top priority is really to obtain additional OC staff. That's the Office of Compliance Examinations and Inspections, which are the examiners who are inspecting all of the registrants, including investment advisors and private fund advisors. She's requested specifically an additional 316 OC staff. Of that, 240 would be devoted solely to overseeing investment advisors. So if she gets her funding, and that's always a question, there really is a very focused attention on the investment advisor sphere. I think that is in part as a result of the long-term recognition of the fact that the SEC is really under-resourced in the area of investment advisor examinations. And the numbers are really staggering. During the last fiscal year, the SEC examined about 9% of advisors, which comprised approximately 25% of the assets under management. And although that gives you potentially good odds if you're a registrant in terms of whether or not you may be examined, the SEC is doing two things. One, trying to obtain additional resources, and two, using the resources that they do have in a more efficient and smarter way. And we'll talk about some of the things that they're doing along those lines.
Jen, just looking at those numbers, 240 additional advisor-focused OC examination personnel, that's a lot of additional inspections that they can conduct each year. It really is a meaningful increase in their resources, and I think that more and more suggests that whenever you're examining something that arises under any of the federal securities laws, it's best to start with a presumption of inevitable discovery.
I think that's right. 240 more examiners is a lot more boots on the ground. And they're conducting smarter exams, which are more targeted and more focused. And so the likelihood of being examined is, I think, higher today than it has been historically. One of the ways that they're trying to be smarter about examinations is by leveraging the special expertise and developing sort of focused examination units. And the most recent one that has been publicized to some degree is the private fund unit. According to press reports, the SEC has developed this unit, which is co-sponsored by two people, one of whom comes from enforcement and the other comes from the examination staff. Initially, the unit's comprised of 12 to 15 staff that are going to be operating out of the Boston, New York, Chicago, and San Francisco regional offices, but that's the pilot, and it's anticipated that that will extend to a broader universe of offices.
And in the past years, we've talked about the examination program and how if you went back maybe 15 years or 20 years, you would think of it as a remedial type of program, and it's more and more aligned with the separate mission of the Enforcement Division, and I think this is just consistent with that. In fact, it's a very direct expression of it.
It shows the success that the SEC has had with the advent of the Asset Management Unit, which is a unit that was formed in the Enforcement Division in 2010, and it's really focused on investment advisors and funds. I think they're finding that by concentrating the special expertise, which they're developing and also pulling from the industry, deploying people in discrete areas, they're much more able to make an impact and to be well-educated when they come in and conduct exams. Another way that they're trying to be more efficient is by increasing the use of analytics, and we're seeing this across both OC and the Enforcement Division. Most recently, there's a new tool called NEAT, the National Exam Analytics Tool, which is in the process of being rolled out to OC examiners. This is going to allow the examiners to have an on their desktop or on their laptop when they're sitting in your offices conducting exams, tool that will allow them to do analytics faster and quicker. And it's loaded with standardized queries that the SEC has developed. It also lets them do customized queries. And so it can analyze a significant amount of trade data and also, you know, other quantitative data that they collect from you very quickly. I think the exam staff is very excited about this initiative, and so you should be aware that, you know, it may impact the way exams are conducted in the future. There may be much more of a focus on the quantitative analytics, and if you're in-house and preparing for an SEC examination or reevaluating your own surveillance around, for example, trading activities or insider trading, it's something that you might want to think about in terms of becoming a little more sophisticated. We're going to turn now to talk about some of the examination priorities for 2014. And the SEC published, helpfully, a list. They started in 2013 and did it again this year on what their priorities are. Some of those priorities are market-wide initiatives, and others of them are focused on discrete areas. We're going to talk briefly about the market-wide initiatives and then spend the balance of our time focused on those initiatives that relate to the investment advisor space. The first, in terms of market-wide initiatives, it's important to note as the continuous theme that the SEC is, you know, increasingly relying on risk monitoring and data analytics to identify fraudulent or unethical behavior. And so this increased investment in and reliance on technology is a theme that will continue.
You know, it's one of those things that I think when the SEC staff and SEC and the staff first started talking about this, it was easy to dismiss it or be a bit skeptical of the approach. But what we really are starting to see now, and you know, the NEAT tool and the information that's being gathered now by all the registrants who are filing under Form PF, these things really are starting to come online.
I think that's right. And I think the SEC, you know, collected, as everyone in the room probably knows, is collecting a significant amount of information on Form PF relating to private funds and their advisors. The amendments to Form ADV to incorporate Item 7, which includes a lot of information about private funds as well. And there's increasing discussion about requesting yet more information so that they can really create a pool of data that they can leverage both to evaluate systemic risks across the industry and also to leverage in the context of specific exams. So in terms of market-wide initiatives, fraud detection and prevention we've discussed, I'll just note that conflicts of interest in enterprise risk management are two themes that run across the entire market. There's been particularly a lot of focus recently on enterprise risk management, and we've talked about it in a lot of our prior panels as well. But to the extent that you don't have currently a sophisticated approach for identifying and managing conflicts, and also evaluating the enterprise-wide risks of your business, it's worth investing time and energy in those areas because the SEC is using those as a starting point for many of the examinations that they're doing. Technology, we've been beating the drum on, but there has been a lot of news in the press relating to technology initiatives that the SEC is focused on, including with respect to cybersecurity. One of the helpful things that we've been seeing OC do increasingly over the past year or two is to issue risk alerts that talk about discrete issues. And either it's a prospective warning or telegraph to the industry that they're going to be focused on a particular issue, which is what they did in the April 15th cybersecurity initiative, where they essentially announced that they will be conducting examinations along the lines of cybersecurity and included a 28-question examination request list that they'll be doing. So if you haven't already looked at that, it's worth taking a look at. That is a broad sweep that's going on right now.
Yeah, I think one of the challenges for clients in this area is that sometimes the OC risk alerts or the other statements, the Division of Investment Management sometimes calls them issues of interest, and they'll issue some guidance, is that they're maybe not exactly on point or they're perhaps overly broad, but it's very, very difficult not to react to them if you are an investment advisor out in the real world, because if something happens to your business in this area, it puts you on the back foot right away. If something happens, there is a loss, there's a client compromise or something like that, mm-hmm. and OC or the SEC told you about this issue and you didn't react to it in any way. It puts you in a bad position to start off with.
I think that, you know, there's often frustration among private fund advisors because a lot of the guidance that comes out of the staff is not focused particularly on that business model, recognizing there are a lot of business models within even the private fund advisor space. But I think it's incumbent to sort of take the themes and take the information and think about how it applies to your particular business model. In terms of market-wide initiatives, the other thing I think the SEC is focused on or is interested in is the impact on the amendments to Rule 506, and in particular the advent of Rule 506C, which permits general solicitation practices subject to certain verification requirements. They've long been anticipating what impact this would have on the market. And I don't know, Tim, to what degree you're really seeing firms relying on 506C and starting to do general advertisements or solicitations.
Yeah, I mean, our experience so far is that I don't think I can think of a single client who has actually taken the plunge at this point, and that there is, at the very least, a desire to wait and see whether there will be guidance provided about what sorts of additional accredited investor verification processes the SEC would expect. But it doesn't change the fact that the SEC themselves, you know, the staff themselves are very, very focused on this issue, and it is a matter of inquiry when you get an examination request.
Yeah, I think they're trying to identify firms who are actually relying on 506C so that they can really look at how it's being implemented. But it's just an interesting theme that's out there. The other thing they're focused on is due diligence on private offerings. And this has really two applications. One is the sort of fund-to-funds model, where a fund is doing due diligence on managers and funds and investing in them. The other is that increasingly, even in the traditional space, we're seeing large sponsors, wirehouses, and managed account programs allocating assets to alternatives and incorporating them into discretionary and non-discretionary advisory programs. And the question in both cases is, what due diligence are you doing as the sponsor on those alternative investments? And is that due diligence sort of sophisticated and industry standard? One of the more helpful risk alerts that the SEC published recently was a risk alert on investment advisor due diligence for alternative investments. And I think it's worth a read for anybody who's in this space. You may recall there was a sweep in September of 2010 on this issue, and this risk alert really explains what the SEC has seen as a result of that sweep in terms of best practices and also in terms of areas where they have concerns. Switching now to core risks, these are the sort of three things that the SEC has identified in the investment advisor space that they're very focused on for 2014. The first is safety of assets and custody. And for those of you who may have been involved in some of the presence examinations that started in 2012, this was an initiative that the SEC implemented in order to review and examine investment advisors who had recently become registered, mainly private fund advisors, as a result of the Dodd-Frank changes. One of the significant themes that they found, I think, in conducting those presence exams was that private fund advisors really didn't appreciate the significance of the custody rule and how it applied to their businesses. And so they have issued a risk alert around it that talks about some of the common deficiencies they've seen. And really what they're looking for is, one, an acknowledgement that an advisor has custody, if in fact that's true. And then two, making sure that you comply with the technical aspects of the custody rule. In the private fund space, that often means that you're relying on the exemption, which permits you to, so long as you have audited financials for your funds, audited in accordance with GAAP and distributed to investors within 120 or 180 days, you can generally comply easily, quote-unquote, with the provisions of the custody rule. But you really have to start to focus on the details if you're not already, because the SEC, I think, is losing patience for firms who aren't complying strictly with the technicalities.
That's right. If you look at those enforcement cases, you could make an argument that individually, each of them reflected a fairly technical or not particularly significant violation of the custody rule, but the fact that they've been put together and did a press release that sort of bundled them together shows you that the staff is very, very focused on this. And I think want to make sure that investment advisors, particularly at private funds, are focusing not just on custody of the fund's assets themselves, but advisors who have other relationships with clients. Mm-hmm. And you sort of have to look at, I think in the staff's view at least, the entire transaction coming from, where are the assets coming from? Are they going directly into the fund's account when the client is going to withdraw from the fund, or when there are client distributions from the fund, where are those going? And really follow it from beginning to end.
The other area where there is a lot of focus is on conflicts of interest, and we mentioned this earlier as it related to the broad market initiatives, but within the investment advisor space, it really becomes the starting point for a lot of examinations, particularly of private fund advisors. And there are obviously conflicts inherent in the investment management world. And the question becomes really evaluating how you identify the conflicts and how you mitigate them through policies and procedures and through disclosure. But what the SEC is focused on is really any activity that's going to put the advisor or its principals, you know, interests ahead of those of its clients, or to put one set of clients' interests ahead of another. And so undisclosed compensation arrangements, allocation of investment opportunities, controls relating to side-by-side management of funds or accounts where some have a performance fee and some might not, and risk controls and disclosure for liquid investments are some of the areas that are highlighted. But in this space, we see a whole range of different issues associated with conflicts, including relationships with affiliates, preferential terms within funds, co-investment opportunities, relationships with portfolio companies, allocation of expenses, which I know Ivan and Mary Jo mentioned, and valuation, to name a few.
Remember that because there are so many more private fund advisors of all types, whether we're talking about hedge funds, real estate opportunity funds, private equity funds, venture capital funds, these are businesses that the SEC didn't really know about before, mm-hmm. because the advisors weren't registered and the offerings weren't registered. And it's a good idea to look at the conflicts that arise and try to step back and look at them from the perspective of somebody who doesn't know the business and how would they react to it. And I'll give you an example of something that came up recently was in the venture capital area. There's this concept of operating partners, and an operating partner is really somebody who's going to run the portfolio company business but is somewhere in the GP structure for purposes of carry. Mm-hmm. And the SEC clearly didn't know what the role of an operating partner was and was raising questions about it. And you realize that the documentation in the fund really could have been clearer in certain areas. But if you're a manager and you're on your fifth fund and you're in the venture capital area, you can sort of come to it with some pre-existing knowledge that might bias the way you describe things. The staff is flagging issues de novo. And it, to the extent you can, it's good to step back and try to take that de novo approach to evaluating the conflicts.
And that's something that is helpful to build into the sort of compliance policy and program that you're running. because one component of that overall program should be an evaluation of conflicts and an analysis of how you're addressing them. The other area, which is an oldie but a goodie, is marketing and performance. And the SEC continues to be very focused in this space, both with respect to the advisor's own statements about its performance and how it markets its services. So just to put it in context, last year we saw a lot of cases and focus on hypothetical performance, back-tested performance, inflated performance, many of those cases coming out of the aberrational performance review that Mary Jo referenced. This year, we're seeing that, but we're also seeing a lot of focus on the representations that advisors are making about their capabilities to potential clients and to investors. And so it's just a slightly different approach to the same issue. We talked about the presence exams earlier, which were really focused on newly registered private fund advisors. Again, the SEC has created a new initiative for never-before-examined advisors that is sort of parallel to the presence exams and is really designed to pick up advisors who've been registered with the commission for more than 3 years, so were already registered before Dodd-Frank, but haven't been examined in a significant period of time. And this is, again, their attempt to, I think, get more information about the registrant universe and also to reach out to advisors that they might not have warmly embraced yet. The exams are conducted in two ways. One is just a general sort of risk assessment to understand the business, look at compliance program and disclosures. The other are more targeted examinations that are focusing on things like the compliance program, filings and disclosure, marketing, performance, portfolio management, and custody. I mention it to this audience because many large firms were registered well in advance of the 2010-2011 time period. And if you haven't been examined, and particularly if you're conducting a diverse business that includes alternative products and also more traditional, you may be seeing the SEC more in the near future. The next thing to mention is just new and emerging issues. One of the areas of focus that might be of interest to this audience is on quantitative trading models. And this is a recognition that firms that rely heavily on quantitative models to deploy their investment strategies really should have a compliance program and infrastructure that's tailored to that business. This harkens back to a case from a couple of years ago, the AXA Rosenberg case, which involved issues that came up in the model that the quant manager was deploying. Essentially, there were changes to the model that weren't properly tested, and the result was a significant negative impact on the performance and earnings of client accounts. And so at that point, there was a lot of focus on how to make sure you have a compliance program that, without having your compliance officer need to be able to really write the code, how are you managing things like change management of your code or your models, and what sort of testing is going on, and is it really focused on the quantitative business?
The other aspect of the AXA Rosenberg case that continues, I think, to be an issue for quantitative managers is the concept of trade errors in a quantitative model. The staff will not hesitate to assert, I think there are good arguments to the contrary, but the staff won't hesitate to assert that managers are strictly liable for their trade errors. And in a quantitative model, there can sometimes be an ambiguity about whether a trade was just a poor decision outcome from the model or whether it was an error that's right. built into the model. And that was clearly an issue in the AXA Rosenberg case, and I think it continues to be something to be managed very carefully by quantitative managers.
Yep, and even more broadly, there was a case earlier this year in January against Western Asset Management that involved their error policy and the interpretation of that policy.
Yep.
And I think the staff was critical. Whether there was an error was in fact perhaps more narrowly defined than the staff would have looked at. Now, that wasn't specifically in the quant space, but it raises this issue of trade errors. It continues to be a real issue. And then last but not least, it's probably worth mentioning the policy topics. You know, one of the areas that the SEC is interested in, and in fact, they've announced that there's going to be a sweep of alternative investment companies in 2014. Is the situation where you have hedge fund-like or other alternative strategies that are being made available downstream to retail investors through registered products? And I think we're seeing increasingly a lot of advisors who were historically managing only private funds that were, you know, offered in reliance on 3C1 or 3C7, really thinking about how to implement their strategies into a registered product.
Yeah, and that is something that I think sees a lot of demand in the marketplace because of a trend that we'll talk about on another panel, which is the increased desire to put alternative strategies into defined contribution plans.
So in this space, it's worth noting that the SEC has said that they're focused on things like leverage, liquidity, and valuation, policies and practices, the staffing, the funding, and the relationship of the board, and the manner in which these funds are marketed to investors.
So Jen, do you have any key takeaways?
You know, I think the message is that we're continuing to see a significant uptick in investment advisor examinations and enforcement actions. And the SEC is increasingly trying to get smarter as it relates to the alternative space and to really understand what it means to manage private equity funds versus venture capital versus hedge funds versus real estate. It's worth taking a look at some of their themes and priorities and taking it seriously.
Yep, I think that's good advice.
To listen to other panels from the 2014 7th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit PodcastCentral at morganlewis.com. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius, LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefundsresources.